United National Anti-War Movement from the U.S. Thank you very much to both of you.
And thanks to all of you for following this edition of The Debate.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pakhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah. كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran rejects a statement by the US and France about the JCPOA, saying it is up to Washington to make the decision on reviving the deal. The family of George Floyd says the prison sentence given to the officer who killed the African American man is not enough.
This right here is this 22-year sentence they gave this man. It's a slap on the wrist.
Also ahead, the Taliban say they have the right to react if the U.S. keeps its troops on Afghan soil after a deadline for its military withdrawal. Thank you for joining us. Our top story: Tehran says it will return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only after the United States removes its sanctions on Iran in a verifiable manner. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said Iran has unilaterally held the agreement alive since the U.S. left the agreement, and the European sides to the deal couldn't live up to their commitments. Saeed Khatibzadeh said it is the United States, not Iran, which must make the decision on returning to the deal by removing its illegal sanctions. The remarks come after the U.S. and France said it was up to Iran to take the final difficult decisions to revive the deal. Khatibzadeh said Washington's complete non-compliance with the JCPOA has, in effect, impeded the implementation of the deal. Political commentator Jan Oberg says the European sides to the Iran nuclear deal failed to create an alternative to offset U.S. sanctions. He says instead of repeating the U.S. narrative, they should put pressure on Washington to rejoin the deal.
European Union and the countries in Europe behind the JCPOA have not been able to create an alternative to the U.S. and its secondary sanctions and other things. And I'm not surprised that if, you know, there's a kind of convenience in saying these things about Iran at the moment. You should do this, you should do that, you should do this, you should do that. But they themselves should put pressure long ago on the United States to behave itself and come back to the agreement according to international law. I mean, you hear this again and again, that we need to, that the U.S. Promotes a rules-based international order. It doesn't. It doesn't uphold international law. It doesn't respect UN Security Council resolutions by leaving. And it has only one thing to do, that is say, sorry, the former administration did something we definitely are not behind anymore. Let Biden show that he's different from Trump.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has denounced the U.S. government's move to seize dozens of media websites. He says the main reason behind the decision is the outlet's support for the Palestinian cause. Mariam Saleh is in Beirut.
Hezbollah Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah began his televised speech by denouncing the U.S. administration's decision to seize and block dozens of website domains connected to Iranian and regional media outlets.
It's not coincidental that these websites which were seized are media outlets that had a major role in supporting the Palestinians in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. They all have a clear position from the Zionist enemy and the American hegemony over the region. These outlets are critical of sedition and terrorism, specifically Takfiri terrorism. This gives us and the free people of the world another piece of evidence against the false claims of the U.S. administration, which claims to defend freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
Said Nasrallah also criticized U.S. statements that attempt to incite the Lebanese army against the resistance. Said Nasrallah noted that U.S. officials have tried to justify their humble support to the Lebanese army by stressing that this assistance is aimed at giving the army leverage to confront Hezbollah. This, Said Nasrallah says, will not happen since the National Army is the main guarantor for peace in the country. On another note, the resistance leader explained how Hezbollah has been exerting an effort to mediate talks for the formation of the cabinet.
All efforts in the country must come together to form a government and to pull the country out of this dilemma. Since Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was named by most members of parliament, we have been working on a quick formation of the cabinet. We have been supportive of an initiative from Speaker Berry, and we will work on finding resolutions to the last few disagreements in the talks.
Experts believe Said Nasrallah's words and sufferings of the people lining up at gas stations and pharmacies should be an incentive for the officials to find solutions.
Sayyid Nasrallah said there is no magical solution, and he stressed that the crisis should be disintegrated and resolved one by one until the government is reestablished. If we want to go back to the state where the government collects taxes and the citizens practice their rights and responsibilities in paying taxes, where there are investments in the country again and we create more job opportunities, all of these issues need political stability, and political stability will be the only first step to genuinely solve the many crises in the country.
Said Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has accomplished all the administrative and logistic preparations for importing gasoline and fuel from Iran to Lebanon in case the state fails to cover the fuel shortage. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Elsewhere, former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin is sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of African-American George Floyd during an arrest in May 2020 in the city of Minneapolis. This comes after a jury found 45-year-old Chauvin guilty on April 20 of unintentional second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. Chauvin has been held at the state's maximum security prison in Oak Park Heights since his conviction. The three other police officers involved in Floyd's arrest are due to face trial next year on charges of aiding and abetting his murder. Meanwhile, civil rights activists as well as members of Floyd's family have reacted to Chauvin's sentence.
This sentencing is the longest sentence we've seen, but it is not justice, because George Floyd is in a grave tonight, even though Chauvin will be in jail.
When you think about George being murdered in cold blood with a knee on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, execution style in broad daylight, 22 and a half years is not enough.
This right here is this 22-year sentence they gave this man. It's a slap on the wrist. We serving a life sentence of not having them in our life, and that hurts me to death.
We didn't get what we wanted. We definitely wanted to see the maximum penalty, but however, as they've already stated, we do have the federal ahead of us.
U.S. President Joe Biden also reacted to the sentence, saying it seemed to be appropriate. The video of the white officer kneeling on the neck of the unarmed black man in handcuffs for more than 9 minutes sparked outrage around the world. Rights activist Netfa Freeman says the trial of the police officer who killed George Floyd was a stunt to distract African Americans from their main demands.
I think what we're seeing here is more bait and switch and distraction. When they focus, and the media is complicit in this, the U.S. corporate media, because what they do when they focus on trials like this, they're trying to distract what the ultimate goal and the primary goal of the movements, the uprisings are. And they're not to just get justice. justice through convicting one bad apple. So that the people kind of can get distracted by that, and the sentences which we can't be satisfied with because the system can't afford to really rein in its police, is rein in this force that protects and serves the settler colonial system, white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy. So they decided to throw Derek Chauvin under the bus. As we can see, his lawyers were trying to get a new trial, which was denied because they had already decided we're going to give that a concession to the people. But actually, it's not really anything that addresses the repression that the people face as a result of being colonized, as a result of being poor and working class by a capitalist system.
The World Health Organization has criticized the shortage of coronavirus vaccines in poor countries, calling it a global failure.
The world, as international community, other world is failing. As global community, we are failing. The problem is vaccine supply. And even now, it's not the absorptive or the delivery problem that's a problem. There is no vaccine.
The WHO chief said the vaccination situation in many low-income countries, especially in Africa, is worrisome. He said while less than 2% of the population is vaccinated in these countries, the infections are surging by 50% on a weekly basis. He also raised concern about the Delta variant that first emerged in India and its rapid spread among unvaccinated populations. Gabriesus said the only way to prevent the emergence of new variants is to thwart further transmission of the virus. He warned that otherwise new variants will continue to emerge. The head of Afghanistan's Peace Council has called for the continuation of long-stalled talks on a political settlement with Taliban militants despite their surging attacks.
I think we shouldn't shut the doors unless it's completely shut by the Taliban. Today also, we cannot say no to talks, in spite of lack of progress in negotiations or in spite of what's happening on the ground. Because eventually, the last man killed will not be a solution. There has to be a peaceful settlement.
Abdullah said an absolute majority of the Afghan people want an inclusive peace settlement. He said the people cannot continue fighting forever because that's not the solution. Abdullah spoke after he and President Ashraf Ghani met with U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House. Last week, the Taliban said that they are committed to peace talks, but their rising violence and seizure of several areas in northern Afghanistan have raised fears about the prospect of an ongoing dialogue in Qatar. New developments come ahead of the planned withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan on September 11th. Meanwhile, the Taliban say they have the right to react if the United States keeps its troops on Afghan soil after a deadline for its military withdrawal. A Taliban spokesman told Al Jazeera News that keeping the troops in the country would be a clear violation of the 2020 Doha agreement with Washington. The comments come after U.S. officials said about 650 American troops are expected to stay in Afghanistan past the September 11th deadline to provide security for the country's diplomats. Amin Alami is our correspondent in the Afghan capital, Kabul, and joins us now. Amin, welcome. Can you tell us about this reaction by the Taliban, who say essentially they have the right to take up arms against the U.S. after its promised pledged withdrawal in September and consider it as an occupying power?
Of course, the Taliban has always named not only the U.S. but all foreign troops as occupation forces and have repeatedly stressed that we will continue our fight against these forces that is being titled as the Holy Jihad against the foreign occupiers of Afghanistan. But let's not forget that this is not only the U.S. forces or other foreign troops that are being targeted by the Taliban militants since the oust of the Taliban regime back in 2001. Since this period, the Taliban have also targeted Afghan security forces, Afghan armed forces, and even civilian employees of government. In many cases, and according to official reports and statistics released by many human rights bodies in Afghanistan, thousands of Afghan civilians have also been killed as a result of rising violence in this country, mainly due to expansion of Taliban attacks. But the recent visit of top Afghan officials to the United States proved that the Afghan government is, after attracting more foreign attention to Afghan issues, mainly the Afghan politicians are doing their best to make a united front with the United States. But in the meantime, some top Afghan officials and even influential political leaders in this country have urged hundreds of local Afghans to pick up guns against Taliban attacks, mainly in northern Afghanistan. For instance, I can point out to what happened in Baghlan, Tahar, and Balkh provinces. All of these provinces are located in northern Afghanistan. As official reports confirm, hundreds of civilians, including religious scholars, have picked up guns in across northern parts of this country as an act of resistance against Taliban attacks. As a result, two key districts that were already captured by the Taliban militants in Baghlan province of Afghanistan, I mean Dushi and Khinjan, were also liberated by Afghan security forces as well as public uprising forces. In the meantime, another key issue, an important fact, is that the Afghan government, the United States, and other foreign...
So, I mean, there is rising violence as a result of military operations by the Taliban. How is that going to unfold? How will the future look like for Afghanistan when you've got the rising violence and at the same time you've got the head of the Afghan Peace Council, Abdullah Abdullah, saying or calling for the continuation of talks with the Taliban?
Of course, it's expected that there would be only one way to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan. That is the approval of two key summits by the Taliban. But this is also important to realize that earlier the Afghan government, the NATO, and the United States had proposed that Turkish forces must be deployed after the withdrawal of all foreign troops from Afghanistan. They had said that the Turkish forces must be deployed in Kabul International Airport for security measures, but instead it remains to be seen if the Taliban approve such demand or not. In a separate case, the Taliban reacted to this proposal of the Afghan government and the NATO and said that given Turkey is a NATO member and it is considered as an occupier force, so the Taliban will not agree to allow the Turkish forces to stay in Afghanistan, mainly to stay in Kabul International Airport. In such circumstances, it's expected that the Taliban leadership will enter again to the blacklist of the United Nations, and the war will again rise and violence will again take the lives of more civilians in this country.
Okay, Amin, thank you very much indeed for that. Amin Alami there, our correspondent, joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
and Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who murdered George Floyd, has been sentenced to 22 years and 6 months for second-degree murder. Closing one chapter of a case that thrust the issue of race and American policing back into the global spotlight. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Oliver Lachlan. The piece is titled, Derek Chauvin Sentenced to 22.5 Years in Prison for Murder of George Floyd. Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who murdered George Floyd, has been sentenced to 22 years and 6 months for second-degree murder, closing one chapter of a case that thrust the issue of race and American policing back into the global spotlight. The 45-year-old appeared in court on Friday, 25th of June, dressed in a gray suit and with a shaved head, 2 months after a jury found him guilty on 3 charges relating to George Floyd's death. The sentence issued by the Hennepin County Judge, Peter Cahill, was a 10-year increase to the state's recommended sentencing guidance for second-degree murder. Prosecutors successfully argued that Derek Chauvin should face harsher sentencing due to a range of aggravating factors. Judge Peter Cahill offered only brief remarks before delivering the sentence, saying his decision was not based on emotional sympathy, but adding, I want to acknowledge the deep and tremendous pain that all the families are feeling, especially the Floyd family. Judge Peter Cahill explained his reasoning for the harsher sentence in a 22-page sentencing memorandum released by the court, writing, "Part of the mission of the Minneapolis Police Department is to give citizens voice and respect. Here, Mr. Chauvin, rather than pursuing the Minneapolis Police Department mission, treated Mr. Floyd without respect and denied him the dignity owed to all human beings, and which he certainly would have extended to a friend or neighbor." The announcement followed victim impact statements from members of the Floyd family, including his 7-year-old daughter, Gianna. In a recorded video message, she was asked what she would say to her father today. Gianna said, "It would be, I miss you and I love him," she said. Prosecutors sought a maximum sentence of 30 years, a plea reiterated by members of the Floyd family as they delivered statements in person. "Every day I have begged for justice to be served. Reliving the execution of George, while others begged, they pleaded for Officer Chauvin to simply just allow George to take a breath," Floyd's brother, Philanese Floyd, told the court. "I haven't had a real night's sleep because of the nightmares I constantly have hearing my brother beg and plead for his life over and over again." Terrence Floyd, another of George Floyd's brothers, directly addressed the former police officer who sat before him showing little visible emotion. "I wanted to know from the man himself why. What were you thinking? What was going through your head when you had your knee on my brother's neck? When you knew that he posed no threat anymore, he was handcuffed, why you didn't at least get up, why you stayed there?" Keith Ellison, the Minnesota Attorney General whose office brought the case to trial, described the sentence as one of the longest a former police officer has ever received for an unlawful use of deadly force. He called it another moment of real accountability on the road to justice. "My hope for Derek Chauvin is that he uses his long sentence to reflect on his choices and his life," Keith Ellison said. "My hope is that he will be able to find it within himself to acknowledge the impact of his choices on George Floyd, on his family, his fellow police officers, and the world." The famed civil rights attorney, Benjamin Crump, who represents the George Floyd family and other victims of police violence, described the punishment as a historic sentence that brings the Floyd family and our nation one step closer to healing by delivering closure and accountability. George Floyd's sister, Bridget Floyd, said in a statement, "The sentence handed down today to the Minneapolis police officer who killed my brother George Floyd shows that matters of police brutality are finally being taken seriously. However, we have a long way to go and many changes to make before black and brown people finally feel they are being treated fairly and humanely by law enforcement in this country." Under Minnesota good behavior law, Derek Chauvin could serve only 2/3 of the sentence in prison, with the rest under license released. Earlier on Friday, Judge Peter Cahill rejected a motion by defense attorneys for a new trial. Derek Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, requested the court issue a probatory sentence only. Derek Derek Chauvin spoke briefly to the court, suggesting that additional legal matters prevented him from speaking at length. Very briefly, though, I want to give my condolences to the Floyd family. There's going to be some other information in the future that would be of interest, and I hope some things would give you some peace of mind, he said. Derek Chauvin's mother, Carolyn Polenti, asked the court to show restraint and said, despite the unanimous guilty verdicts on second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter, that her son was innocent. She did not address the Floyd family. My son's identity has also been reduced to that of a racist, she said. I want this court to know that none of these things are true and that my son is a good man. She added, the public will never know the loving and caring man he is, but his family does. Even though I have not spoken publicly, I have always supported him 100% and always will. George Floyd's death on 25th of May 2020 ignited racial justice protests around the United States and the wider world. Derek Chauvin's trial was seen as a litmus test for police accountability in the United States.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
June 10, a
political prisoners serving a life sentence in Bahrain died after contracting COVID-19. The tiny kingdom in the Persian Gulf has come under pressure from human rights organizations over poor prison conditions. Since the March outbreak of the disease in Bahrain's main prison, Jowl, families have been holding protests demanding the release of political prisoners and better conditions, all in vain. The 48-year-old prisoner, a Shia Muslim, was taken from prison to Salmania Hospital on May 29 and was placed on a ventilator in an ICU unit. Shortly after, he slipped into a coma and died a few days later. Hussein Barakat was sentenced in 2018, along with 53 other individuals, to life in prison in a mass trial of 138 Bahraini citizens due to their opposition to the regime's decades-old discrimination and tyranny. He was also stripped of his citizenship, which was later restored by royal decree. Reportedly, there were 15 prisoners in Barakat's cell, which had only 10 beds, hence some of the inmates had to sleep on the floor. Bahraini human rights activist Mariam Khawaja, whose own father is imprisoned in Jowl, said Barakat told his wife during his last phone call that he could not breathe and was going to die. The fact is, since the outbreak of the coronavirus inside Bahrain prisons, preventative measures inside prisons have not been implemented, and the authorities continue the policy of deliberate medical neglect.
They are known for their unhealthy environment and lack of basic necessities, especially at this dire time and at this crucial time the pandemic outbreak. And those prisoners, as we know, normal patients, the people who are outside the prison suffer a lot. So what about those who are in prison, who already are suffering?
Meanwhile, dissolved Bahraini opposition group Al-Wafaq has been calling for the release of prisoners of conscience since the start of the pandemic. According to Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain, a second outbreak at Jowl began on the 22nd of May and has infected an estimated 60% of the 255 political prisoners housed at Building 12 of the prison. An earlier outbreak in March saw at least 140 inmates infected with the virus. Byrd estimates that the total number of COVID cases in both Jowl and the Dry Dock Detention Center has far exceeded 200 cases since March.
This, of course, amounts to a deliberate killing, to a political assassination, as if the government of Bahrain, if not murdering those prisoners during torture, during executions, it's now dealing with the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic as an opportunity to revenge against those political prisoners, merely because those political prisoners, those peaceful protesters, political activists, human rights defenders, clerics.
Speaking from inside the Dry Dock Detention Center, inmate Ali Al-Haji said, "Most prisoners are mistreated, physically and mentally. It's always the same thing, torture and a lack of proper medical care." Particular concern has been raised about the aging leaders of the 2011 pro-democracy uprising, including Hassan Mushaima, who is in his 80s and suffers serious health conditions, placing him at high risk from coronavirus.
The only crime of those political prisoners is that they have called for an elected government, for a constitutional monarchy, for a new constitution which guarantees their rights, their freedoms, which tolerates all citizens equally.
In the words of Hussein Abdullah, executive director of ADHRB, following this tragic death, the Biden administration and the UK government must make clear to their Bahraini allies that holding political opponents as hostages will no longer be tolerated.
The Bahraini government deals with the political prisoners, more than 3,000 political prisoners, as hostages. It neglects their rights merely because those people have once took to the streets and called for their basic freedoms, their basic rights. So it's the same practice, as the practices of the Zionist occupiers against the Palestinians. They have a lot of commonalities between those two parties. So they deal with those people as they are hostages. They neglect their rights.
Hossein Barakat's son, Ali Barakat, is also serving a 22-year sentence in jail. After being convicted on political charges in a separate case when he was just 16. Despite an earlier outbreak of COVID-19 at the prison in March and April 2021, the prison administration had still failed to distribute face masks or hand sanitizer to protect prisoners. Overcrowding in Bahrain's prisons is a long-standing concern which makes social distancing impossible. In early April, inmates at Bahrain's Jao prison protested against the lack of medical treatment and fearing for their lives after the death of another inmate. Prison authorities instead threw stun grenades, beating inmates with batons to force them back inside their overcrowded cells.
The inmates have been protesting about conditions of detention, in particular the lack of access to medical treatment. The sit-in began on 5th April after a political prisoner, Aba Mal Ala, died after reportedly being denied timely access to essential health care. The lack of health care in the overcrowded Bahraini prisons has been an issue for years, but has become a chronic problem during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hossein Barakat's death could have been avoided had the Bahraini regime heeded calls to set free political prisoners so as to prevent the spread of the virus.
Victim Hossein Barakat hasn't been the first victim who passed inside the Bahraini prisoners. We have a lot of cases. We have Martyr Karim Fakhrawi, who died in prison and because of torture. We have the case of Sayyid Qadim al-Sahlawi. Also, we have the case of Martyr Muhammad Sahwan, who had mostly 80 shrapnels in his head because of the riot police. There are a lot of cases of prisoners who passed away inside those notorious prisons merely because of torture, of medical neglect.
With overcrowded cells, unsanitary conditions, and a lack of preventative measures, this disastrous outbreak seems to continue and claim more lives of those whose only crime was calling for freedom and democracy.
limelight.
A laborer discovered a fossil and hid it in a well for 85 years in Harbin in northern China's province of Heilongjiang during the Japanese occupation. Scientists say it could help sort out the human family tree and how our species emerged. We now present you an article written by The Guardian science editor Ian Sample. The piece is titled Massive Human Head in Chinese Well Forces Scientists to Rethink Evolution. The discovery of a huge fossilized skull that was wrapped up and hidden in a Chinese well nearly 90 years ago has forced scientists to rewrite the story of human evolution. Analysis of the remains has revealed a new branch of the human family tree that points to a previously unknown sister group, more closely related to modern humans than the Neanderthals. The extraordinary fossil has been named a new human species, Homo longi, or Dragon Man by Chinese researchers, although other experts are more cautious about the designation. Professor Chris Stringer, research leader at the Natural History Museum in London, who worked on the project, said, "I think this is one of the most important finds of the past 50 years," adding, "It's a wonderfully preserved fossil." The skull appears to have a remarkable backstory. According to researchers, it was originally found in 1933 by Chinese laborers building a bridge over the Songhua River in Harbin, in China's northernmost province of Heilongjiang, during the Japanese occupation. To keep the skull from falling into Japanese hands, it was wrapped and hidden in an abandoned well, resurfacing only in 2018 after the man who hid it told his grandson about it shortly before he died. An international team led by Professor Qiang Ji at the Hebei Geo University in China drew on geochemical techniques to narrow down when the skull came to rest in Harbin, dating the bones to at least 146,000 years ago. The skull has a unique combination of primitive and more modern features, with the face in particular most closely resembling Homo sapiens. One huge molar remains. Which is 23 centimeters long and more than 15 centimeters wide, is substantially larger than a modern human skull and has ample room at 1,420 milliliters for a modern human brain. Beneath the thick brow ridge, the face has large square eye sockets, but is delicate despite its size. Professor Stringer said, "This guy had a huge head." The researchers believe the skull belonged to a male about 50 years old who would have been an impressive physical specimen. His wide bulbous nose allowed him to breathe huge volumes of air, indicating high-energy lifestyle, while sheer size would have helped him withstand the brutally cold winters in the region. Professor Xi Junyi, a paleoanthropologist at Hebei Geo University, said, "Homo longi is heavily built, very robust," adding, "It is hard to estimate the height, but the massive head should match a height higher than the average modern human." To work out where the Harbin individual fitted into human history, the scientists fed measurements from the fossil and 95 other skulls into software that compiled the most likely family tree. To their surprise, the Harbin Skull and a handful of others from China formed a new branch closer to modern humans than Neanderthals. The Chinese researchers believe the Harbin Skull is distinct enough to make it a new species, but Professor Stringer is not convinced. He believes it is similar to another skull found in Dali County in China in 1978. He said, "I prefer to call it Homo daliensis, but it's not a big deal." Professor Stringer added, "The important thing is a third lineage of later humans that are separate from Neanderthals and separate from Homo sapiens." Details are published in three papers in The Innovation. Whatever the name, one possibility is that the Harbin Skull is Denisovan, a mysterious group of extinct humans known largely from DNA and bone fragments recovered from Siberia. Professor Stringer said, "Certainly this specimen could be Denisovan, but we have to be cautious. What we need is much more complete skeletal material of the Denisovans alongside DNA evidence." Professor John Hawkes, a paleoanthropologist at University of Wisconsin at Madison, said the idea of a new lineage of humans was a provocative claim because skulls can look similar even among distant relatives. He added the skull being Denisovan was a good hypothesis, though he was less keen on a new species name. He said, "I think it's a bad moment in science to be naming new species among these large-brained humans that all interbred with each other." He added, "What we are repeatedly finding is that the differences in looks didn't mean much to these ancient people when it comes to breathing." Mark Maslin, a professor of Earth System Science at University College London and the author of The Cradle of Humanity, said, "The beautifully preserved Chinese Harbin archaic human skull adds even more evidence that human evolution was not a simple evolutionary tree, but rather a dense, intertwined bush. We now know that there were as many as 10 different species of hominins at the same time as our own species emerged." Mark Maslin, a professor of Earth System Science at University College London, added, "Genetic analysis shows that these species interacted and interbred. Our own genetics certainly contained a legacy of many of these ghost species. But what is a sobering thought is that despite all this diversity, a new version of Homo sapiens emerged from Africa about 60,000 years ago, which clearly outcompeted, outbred, and even outfought these other closely related species, causing their extinction. It is only by painstaking research and analysis of their fossils, such as the Harbin skull, do we know of their existence."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
2009 study published by the CIA says how beneficial it could be to use universities as a means of intelligence training, noting that exposure to an academic environment such as the Department of War Studies at King's College London can add several elements that may be harder to provide within the government system. The paper, written by two King's College staffers, is essentially a request to the Central Intelligence Agency to send more of its recruits there. In 2013, former CIA director Leon Panetta took time out of his schedule as the U.S. Secretary of Defense to pay a visit to the Department of War Studies and expressed his deep gratitude to it.
It was 70 years ago.
One of King's College's most famous professors is Matt Spurdle. Before joining the college in 2018, he was director of studies at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS, a leading think tank in the world. The institute is directly funded by NATO and its member states, as well as by major weapons manufacturers such as Airbus, BAE Systems, Boeing, and Raytheon. In 2016, the IISS was the subject of a major scandal after it was found to have secretly accepted £25 million from Bahrain. Today, IISS is a major player in the growing hostility towards China, Russia, and North Korea. A number of other current Department of War Studies academics have held positions at the IISS as well. Indeed, King's College boasts that among the key benefits of studying there is its established links with the IISS. Another famous member of King's College's Department of War Studies is Professor Sir Lawrence Freedman, a powerful figure in British politics. Freedman contributed to the then British Prime Minister Tony Blair's speech in the year 1999, in which he established the Blair Doctrine, according to which NATO could and should militarily intervene anywhere in the world to stop what they considered to be human rights violations. Whereas the institution takes great pride in promoting independent thought, there exists a significant overlap between the staff of the Department of War Studies and the halls of power of the British state. And the distributing point is that many of these faculty members are basically warmongers. Sir Malcolm Rifkind, visiting professor at King's College, for example, rejected the idea that the United Kingdom should use atomic missiles only as a last resort after being attacked. Instead, he believes and insists that the country could also use them simply to deliver an unmistakable message of Britain's willingness to defend her vital interests. It is not just British officials who teach King's College students, however. Christopher Kalender, for example, has the experience of commanding a US task force in Afghanistan under his belt. The department also has a number of Israeli academics, including Ofer Fridman, who served as an officer in the IDF between 1999 and 2011, during which time it was carrying out some of its worst war crimes against Palestine and Lebanon. After leaving the IDF, Fridman became an arms dealer. In 2016, King's College also hosted a lecture by a former head of Shin Bet, the Israeli secret police force. Whereas the War Department's teaching staff are a cause of concern, much of King's College academic output is even more disturbing and seems to be totally in line with that of NATO and weapons contractors. For instance, one study titled "A Benefit, Not a Burden," the security, economic, and strategic value of Britain's defense industry looks more like a press release from an arms manufacturer in which it praises the benefits of the arms industry, such as job creations for many people. While King's College gives an academic appearance to the national security state, Bellingcat, an investigative site in close cooperation with the college, provides a journalistic one. This bunch of think tanks, academic reports, and so-called investigative articles all cite